This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. They offer just about every battery under the sun, from car and truck batteries to batteries for your trail cameras and rangefinders. Select retail locations even offer cell phone repair and cracked screen repair. Find a local retail location at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
When in the field, accuracy and precision count. That's why we switch our slug guns to rifled barrels, tune our arrows, and use a fish finder on the water. But why should our drive for control end there? The Tapicue line of meat probes gives an instantaneous look at the temperatures of our prized meals, both internal and the cooking chamber. Tapicue uses sturdy hardware made and assembled here in the U.S., along with their user-friendly, sophisticated software that connects to your smart device. Whether it's a traditional corded probe or the new cordless air probes that give you a wealth of freedom where wires would just get in the way. Adding a Tapicue meat probe can significantly help in getting to that medium rare on venison or waterfowl, ensuring your upland bird stays moist, or even charting your long cooks on a smoker. Visit Tapicue.com or find the link in the show notes and use the code HUNT10, all uppercase, at checkout to save 10%. Adding a probe to your kit can make you one tap away from your cue.
Welcome
Welcome to the Huntivore Podcast, powered by Sportsman's Nation, where we celebrate the hunting and fishing lifestyle through the utilization and consumption of our wild game. No egos.
Fork in hand, beer in the other.
No status.
A piece of red meat on a hot grill and turn it into a burnt offering.
Just catch it, cut it, cook it. This is episode 80, Field Care and Meat Care with Travis Stockstill. On this episode of Huntivore, Nick calls up Travis Stockstill, member of Team USA Butchering and the host of the Meat Block podcast, to talk about field care and prepping your carcass for better meat quality. Using his expertise from over a decade in the butcher's trade, he gives some tips and tricks hunters can use, whether it's taking your animal to the processor or having a DIY butcher job in your garage. If you're a fan of geeking out over meat, this is an episode for you. Well, hey, folks, beautiful afternoon here in Michigan. Storms have rolled through. Cleanup has begun. And yeah, we're living with less humidity, but we're still feeling the temps, which is good because summer's not over. But by the time you're hearing this, summer will be over. It'll be September, and we will be in the midst of getting ready for the big kickoff. I mean, waterfowl will have already started, and we're going to be gunning up for, or I should say gearing up. We're going to be getting our bows, final checks for whitetail. Guys out west are be heading for elk, and we're going to be ready to be able to bring that game down. But instead of thinking about the shot, we got to think about after the shot. We got to be thinking about what to do with that down animal. We're going to be bringing that carcass home, and we want to make sure that we get the best out of that valued meat there. So I thought it would be a grand opportunity to bring in a guru with a knife, to bring in the guy who is the host of the Meat Block podcast. He is a team member on the USA Butchering team. I am here with Travis Stockstill. Travis, thank you so much for giving an hour this afternoon. Is there really a USA Butchering team?
First off, am I coming in clear?
Oh, you sound wonderful.
All right.
Buttery good. I tell you what, the deep baritone you got going on. This is very nice.
Yeah, I get compliments on TikTok. there is a United States Butcher team. I'm one of six Americans. I was invited to try out and did head-to-head contest with a good friend of mine, Brian Mayer. And we both ended up making the team. There are six of us plus an alternate and a apprentice junior butcher. And it started off, the World Butchers Challenge was a friendly competition like over a decade ago, just between Australia and New Zealand over a bottle of, I think, scotch.
It's a friendly competition started between Australia and New Zealand, and it's just blown up into this huge event.
Yeah. So we get 3 hours, 15 minutes to break down a side of beef, a side of pork, one lamb, and five chickens into 100% added value product. We are graded on the finished cuts, our creativity, how well we work within the team, as well as how clean we are at the end, how our bones look, how our aprons look. Did you utilize as much as you could?
That's incredible. So you, even though there's a strict regimen of where cuts have to be made, because in the domestic world, you have parameters on each cut that's cut. You, per this rib, you have to cut here, or this joint has to be joined with this joint. And so that's where you have to make your incision. It's just not a hack job here, or where you just get to make stuff up. You got to follow the protocol, but at the same time, like you said, gel with the team and get all that accomplished.
Yeah. And one thing we're actually, I'm getting a weird feedback, so hold on. We practice like you would, like if you were a football team, that everyone has a role. So when we get there, we have routine practices. I'll fly down to Sacramento. Brian Mayer will fly out from Hawaii. And Kevin McCann will fly out from New York. And then we get to to practice through time trials. And we've all, you know, right now, we had to take a break because of the pandemic, but we were seeing our menu and what we were going to put out there. And we're really looking forward to getting to practice again and meeting up and rebuilding those relationships that we had.
Excellent. Excellent. So did the event happen this year or was it postponed?
It's postponed until August 2022.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So we got a little while. So good. I'm glad we didn't miss anything because I saw that you had joined the team and I saw that things were assembling, started watching a bunch of the World Butchering stuff. And then I was just like, wait, when did it happen? You know, I'm just sitting at home waiting for watching like everybody else. So no, it's good to know that that's been at least pushed off. You guys got more time to practice. That is super cool. And I mean, I think I saw the tagline is it's like the Olympics of butchering and anything here in the United States, whatever event it is, I have always seen our nation just step up and be the craziest fans and be all about the athletes that are out there. So I'm hoping that picks up now that we can be representing the U.S. in the right way, that we come out with a bunch of fan crazies and cheer you guys on.
Yeah, it's going to be at the Golden One Arena in Sacramento. So there's room for fans, and it's going to be awesome. There's, you know, the first time America entered the competition, they were competing with 12. It was 12 nations total, and America entered it in late with what someone formed a team. It's incredibly hard to get fundraising to do all the practices, and then you got to fly out to where the competition is. And then it was in Belfast. The next one's in Sacramento, so that's easy.
Nice. And home turf.
Yeah, and they and the American team placed 6 out of 12, and they were happy with that. And like, you know, everyone certainly wants to win, but I just feel super like thankful that I even had the opportunity to try out and that I'm just on the team. That being said, false modesty, I still want to win. So
right. And going what you were talking about, like you were just super grateful to be there. I mean, you're rubbing shoulders with the industry's finest. Talk about the total wave where you come in and you have a knowledge base that is just exploded, that you've got guys that have been in the profession for a seriously long time. They have new ways of doing things, or they're bringing back old ways. What a great time to just as a bunch of butchers, as a bunch of meat cutters get together and just be like, we are going to fine tune our craft to the utmost that it can be. So I'm glad to see that it's still a friendly competition. Is the prize still a bottle of bourbon or has it gotten more than that?
Well, you get a trophy that's presented by Frida Dick, which is a knife company that is the main sponsor of the event. And then you get bragging rights. There's a gala dinner, which is like a real fancy looking dinner. And it's real different than what, so like other countries have, like Australia and Germany and a lot of other European countries have a apprenticeship journeyman master butcher series where 2 years of education until you become a journeyman. And then you get a master's degree in food safety or meat science. And then, then you can consider yourself a master butcher. And then only master butchers are allowed to train apprentices. And we don't have that structure here. So, like, it's, I don't know, I always, view ourselves as, like, the misfits or the little rascals of the industry, but we're certainly, you know, well-rounded as a team. There's generational butchers. There's people who are on the team that were still around when America did apprenticeship programs back when there was meat cutters unions, back when companies leaned into the education before people were so far removed from their protein source or, you know, from the farm aspect. and everyone on the team has worked with whole carcass and worked with, you know, specializing in utilization. We have people who, you know, like half the team owns their own butcher shop. The other half work in like the slaughter and harvesting part of the industry. That also includes like breaking lines and all the way to like retail specifications.
Yeah, that was looking at that. I've talked to a few guys over in England, and you see where that program you're talking about, where it's almost like becoming an electrician or a plumber here in the United States, where, yeah, you've got 2 years of education that by the time you become that journeyman, like, you are well-rounded in that. My upbringing with breaking animals, I grew up on a poultry farm. At about seven, I was handed a pinner, and I was pinning feathers. And then, you know, 8 or 10, now I'm taking off wingtips and drumsticks, you know, and it's, you know, that kind of upbringing. I didn't have anything formal. It was just like, well, here's a knife, you know, sharper the knife, the less you're going to cut yourself. If you don't want to get bloody, point to a buddy. And so that's like, that was my education. And that's kind of how it is in cut houses right now, or like in your setup. Guy comes in like, man, I just need a job. And well, here you go. Here's a knife.
Yeah. And that's how I certainly got into it. I was a journeyman tile setter. And then the 2008 market collapsed, and I was finding myself needing work. And I was living in Southern California. I was like traveling a lot. And it got really clear, like, oh, money's going to run out. So my brother was living in Vermont, and he was working at a slaughterhouse that did beef, lamb, goats, pigs, and then chicken on Friday. So he said, give me 2 years of your life, I'll make you into a career butcher. And I reluctantly flew over there and left Southern California for Vermont in the middle of winter. And it was, there was a definite change. Like for about a year, I just viewed it as more or less a job, until the company I was working for started investing in humane handling certifications and HACCP certifications. Then I realized, oh, this is going to be a career. And my first day, my brother handed me a captive bolt and took a hide marker and marked on the spot of a Holstein's head and said, just knock it right there. And that's certainly not how I recommend anyone to learn that. And I did it. And that was my introductory into USDA animal harvesting.
Holy smokes. Hey, here's a 1,200-pound animal. Drop this thing right here and we'll get to work.
Yeah. And everyone's staring at you too.
Oh, man.
Yeah. The whole floor stopped. All the air saws stopped. And then the added part of that story is afterwards, someone stuck it because I didn't know where to stick it. It was all shackled up and hanging up. And then someone sticks in like all these blood vials to collect blood for sampling, and then starts handing them out to everyone who's standing around. It's like, all right, whenever there's a new guy who knocks, we all take a shot. And I was like, oh, no. And then like, I was like, you're joking, right? And then I could tell very seriously that the person was not joking. So like, all right, 1, 2, 3, we all cheers. And then I was the only one who drank it.
So. Oh man, that, I mean, tell you, that is, yes, that is a trial by fire and a guzzling of blood vial that you were able to join into the brotherhood, the guild of becoming a butcher. That's an incredible story. I guess I don't have anything nearly that intense. There were very colorful folks in the back room, and that's where I kind of got my start there in the back room. So here I am in middle school cleaning up feathers that got pushed onto the floor from the plucker. And of course, there's one of the older veteran guys, and he's like, oh, you got some
you know, shit on your hat. So he grabs my hat and dunks it in the scalder. Puts it back on my head, and he's like, there, that'll clean it all up. And I'm standing by the door, and it's just like, yeah, this intense hot and then cold, and just, yeah, it, you never walk out of there dry. And so it was, I feel you, but at the same time, I think you definitely had a harder entry into the whole thing.
And now I'm just thinking, so like when I used to slaughter chickens, we'd use like a electric knife. That, like, I don't know if you've seen those where, like, you touch it to their temple, their eyes close, and then you slit their throats. But, like, I discovered, like, the person who's taking them off the shackles and putting them in the scalder, that, like, if you timed it right, you could just touch the knife to the rail and just shock that person down.
That's the best.
Yeah. So...
These are those tips and tricks that we need as we continue on. Yeah. Man, I feel like we could break into a lot of this, but I want to make sure we stay focused because we've got a big job ahead of us. We're gonna be killing animals, not via electricity, not via atmospheric stunning, but we're gonna be going through the idea of shooting an animal, either with a gun or a bow, and having to deal with it. I guess on your end, have you ever hunted, or being on the West Coast, I assume you've done your fair bit of fishing.
Yeah. So I've personally never hunted. I have nothing against it. Like I've shot coyotes because protecting fields and things like that. And I own, you know, couple 30-06, couple, you know, like a Beretta duck gun, and I just don't have time, especially now that I'm a father.
Exactly.
But I've taken, you know, long shots on dozens of domestic animals. But I do go fishing. I live on the shores of the Puget Sound, and I go crabbing, I go fishing. I'm friends with a lot of tribal gill netters and tribal fishermen and women so year round I could get access to amazing fish that the Puget Sound has to offer. Right now, pretty soon the Humpties are going to start to run. It's like an older salmon that's heading upriver to spawn. They're only good for smoking, but they're just fun to catch, and there's going to be a lot of them. It's on odd years is when it's they make their run.
Oh, gotcha. Every other or so they end up coming in. That's super cool. The whole West Coast has just an amazing bounty. Like you said, coming from the sea. Here in Michigan, we got the freshwater coast, so we get a lot out of that. But yeah, one of the kings here are, and I'm not referring to the salmon, but just the big run is whitetail. And you guys got a similar thing out there in California. I think you guys got the blacktail. I know mule deer are out there. And you yourself have worked in the game processing aspect. And so that's where I wanted to get into really kind of some of the nitty gritty, that as we put our animals down, and as I try to educate people, like, you know, you can let you want to let your animal sit if you have a bad shot on it, but at the same time, like, getting to that animal and getting that thing field dressed is of the utmost importance. We don't have a captive volt that we can drop that animal right there. Like, that thing's going to run off, and we got to make sure we track it and find it. When I get that animal and I start to field dress it, what are some things that I really want to be able to focus on? What are some things that I should have as a checklist that as I approach that animal with my knife, what do I want to keep thinking about?
Well, one thing is you're not going to know where we're going to shoot the animal, certainly, or where you hit it. But if it's still a closed system, meaning that nothing is exposed from the throat to the butt, then you want to keep it that way when you remove the viscera. So you want to make sure that when you are, if you got it up on a game roller, you're able to tree it, that you maybe bring some twine with you. So when you bung, the animal, you could tie that off. I would do, organ harvesting if you're not used to taking out viscera, and then taking out the liver, to take all those out at the same time, and then harvest your liver on the, you know, once it's removed. Livers are pretty easy to rinse off. Same with hearts and things like that. And then when it comes to the, so you get it all out of the animal, and for deer, it, you don't have to wheeze it, where wheezing is opening up the throat and then tying that off. But you could just do a straight cut from when you see the, what is the wheezing from the stomach going into the diaphragm. You could just make a cut right there, and there, it should be fairly clean. Once you get the viscera out, you're in a good spot at that point. I know a lot of people, I don't know what the ratio is, but I've processed deer where sometimes they'll still come, you know, hide on. And then I process deer where they're already skinned out. So I guess, I don't know if it's a preference thing or if it's but if you're able to remove, so this is what I think. If you have the hide on and you're reaching into it, then you have the hide touching your forearms. You have the hide doing that. And the hide is ultimately a contamination, because the animal is it's outside and exposed to the environment. So there could be fecal material. There could be things that you don't want inside the carcass. So just be conscientious of that. And because when I've done game processing, because I have processed a lot of game for people, that if I'm processing one person's deer, and say I'm processing like 40 deer a day, and one person's is contaminated with fecal material because they didn't do a good sanitary dressing, and I'm boning out and I got 50 pounds of trim, I run that 50 pounds through my grinder, and then I package their 50 pounds, but there's still going to be residue and everything left for the next person that I process. So you want to process not only like, not to your standards of being like, oh, this is good enough for me, but also like, would this be good enough for someone else?
That's an excellent point, especially for folks that are saying, hey, you know what, I'm taking this into the processor, I'm taking this into a professional that's going to work this down for me, that I need to really hold a high standard of cleanliness. That what you're saying is use, or basically once I get that animal eviscerated out, the organs harvested that I want, that you would prefer it that I skin the animal at that point and try to keep as clean as possible.
Well, if you're able to skin it beforehand, before all that as well. I know when you're out there that you don't want to bring a bunch of stuff with you, but like if you're able to remove it and you have some way to wrap it afterwards and, you know, keep the pelt separate from the carcass and also keeping it clean. But I also understand that it may be easier to keep it clean if you keep the hide on until you get to a different place, because, you know, you're out in the woods and you don't know what the conditions could be like. It could be windy. It could be, you know, there could be dust. There could be things falling from the trees, etc. So you want to do what's going to be best for the situation.
Gotcha. I like that you said that it's going to based on what you're doing with what's been presented in front of you. I've tried personally to keep the hide on, inviscerate, and I keep the hide on just for the fact that I'm putting it up in my garage at that point. I'm hanging it up, and it you know, there's dust, like you said, there's dust, there's stuff coming in, stuff coming out. And I just saw that with that membrane holding that pelt onto the animal still, mm-hmm. you know, I've already rinsed the inside of it. I don't have hair falling into the animal or into the cavity that I've pulled that around the sides, but I find I get a better, I don't know, pulling that off just at the time that I'm going to break it down has given me a good result, because it's not been hit by the air or dust and everything that's on there. But again, that's based on the situation. Given something different, I might want to pull that off as quick as possible.
Yeah. And I know people who, my teammate, Brian Mayer, would be, he gets to, what is it? Mule deer. There's a infestation in Hawaii that he harvests them under USDA inspection. So they go out, go hunting at like, start at like 4 a.m. and then start, you know, hunting deer, and then they bring them into a USDA facility and start processing them like within like 20 minutes.
Oh my goodness. I think you're talking about those Axis deer.
That's the Axis.
Yeah, they've had, I guess, one of the islands they're having a problem. You know, here I am raising my hand. I'd love to help. I'd love to help the problem. Wow, so they're actually bringing them into a USDA facility.
There's a USDA truck that goes out, like a mobile slaughter truck. And yeah, the USDA inspector's there. You know, you have the, and I'll talk about like stress, because you're going to be having to take it, under inspection, you get one shot, right? And it has to render the animal insensible. So, and you're not in, you may not be in a controlled environment where, so it's just, a very unique situation.
Yeah. Now these are probably sharpshooters using silenced rifles and every advantage under the sun at this point. I mean, we could call it hunting, but yeah, it's shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah. And, he would be great to talk to, because like, I'm sure there's corralling and stuff that happens beforehand, but
That would be a great discussion. So I've got my animal, I've got it down. I got it inviscerated out the way that I'm going to do that. And now it's coming time to, like, I want to prepare that carcass, or at the same time, you've got 40 deer that have come in and you're preparing them, in a professional sense. It's one of those things like in the door, out of the door, you're cooling it down and then getting to work on it. There's not an aging that goes on, or there's not an extended hang that you're doing on those. Am I right?
So some people would request for like a week hang or something like that. When we would process deer, if there was an aging process, it was just because we'd be so far behind that and that's what it took. Like, you see some of these photos of like game processors in the height of season, and they just have coolers full of
they're game. Just stacked outside the door. And,
yeah. And I've seen that, and it's not something that's good, because a lot of game processors know that this is the time when they're going to make money and they don't want to say no. But what I would truly recommend for any processors out there is when you receive your animal, you sign off on the tag and you get your cut sheets, that you develop a way to track it internally, labeling it, that this is such and such animal, whatever method you use. And then regardless of how the carcass came in, just hit it with a antimicrobial acid, like apple cider vinegar would work real good on help reducing a 7-log reduction in things that would cause foodborne illness, be it from and this is for the processor, because you could get something in that is immaculate and it had the ultimate situation to create a sanitary dressing, but you also got to think that you got to treat it as if it didn't. So,
right. And like you were mentioning earlier, the one next to it could have had little to no care on it. Yeah. So being able to do that on one of your earlier episodes, and folks, if you're into doing your own butchery, either at home or, you know, part of the business, I would highly suggest following along the Meat Block and Travis's podcast. It is a wealth of information. There is also hilarious episodes that I just love hearing, like the customer responses and the different stories that come off of that. But I gleaned a little bit of info, just like you were talking on this, where I necessarily wasn't looking at it as a HACCP, as a log sheet or anything, but I added into my own, I guess, cleanliness standard that I've put in that, yeah, like the apple cider vinegar, or I think I had heard your co-host David talk about, he used red wine vinegar just because he had a bunch of that, and he was using it on lambs. Because wasn't he doing like a big mobile thing and had a whole bunch of lambs and just basically spritz them down? That's an excellent idea. And I think that even a bunch of home DIY butchers could really take a benefit of that because, yeah, we don't have extra carcasses hanging around, but any added bit of sanitariness that we can take is going to be a good thing.
Yeah. And you also got to think about, like, you know, who's going to be eating this? Is it going to be people who are your children are going to be sharing this with your parents and things like that? And I, you know, people do like rarer things. I do. I love a nice, you know, black and blue steak. I like rare hamburgers, but I also got to think that, like, got to take in consideration the food safety aspect of it, you know, in smoking and summer sausage and things like that. So
when you're prepping your area as a professional for domestic, tell me the specific cleaner and disinfectant that you're using, but at the same time, what would be something comparable that I could use as a household item?
So we use like our cleaners are this, like Zep foamers that break down, like these big things that like just break down fat, melt it, and then use 180 degree water. And not only will that get rid of, well, in between that you do scrubbing, but that will get rid of, stuck on fat, but 180 degrees will also sanitize at the same time. And then from there, something that's like real easy that people could get, if you're using like a thing like bleach, you want to make sure you get your mixture right. You know, read if there's going to be mixing instructions. You also want to allow it time to evaporate, because a lot of sanitizers will say like safe to use after X amount of time. Because you don't want to just all of a sudden put meat on and then you have sanitizer in with your meat. Another sanitizer that is good is an iodine sanitizer. And iodine is also organic as well, if people are conscientious of that, versus using a more chemically treated sanitizer. So.
Gotcha. Do you get staining when you've used iodine in the past, or no?
It's again, there's a parts per million mix.
Oh, okay.
So like you're going to want to, you just don't want to put straight iodine, but that's expensive too. And so I would, you know, there'll be a parts per million mix and you mix it to that. And then you just, you know, wipe it on, and then you could even rinse with water at that point, because you already have a sanitized area. And water, you know, your water source, if you're doing it at your house, is going to be up to standards. If you're doing it, you know, in a game processor, they should get their water tested every 2 years. So.
When you've allowed it to hang, do you find that you get a better product? Like you were mentioning that at some point, like, people will request mm-hmm. hey, could you let that hang for 7 days? And given the opportunity as a processor, you said you would do that. And I have found my sweet spot given, again, situationally, mm-hmm. 7 days. Have you personally found with giving it a week that you have had a better, well, I should say, do you get the chance to enjoy some of the venison you process? And have you found that after a couple days of hanging, there is a little bit better of an eating experience? Or are you saying, like, you know what, it's pretty much the same between day one to day seven?
I don't know when it is specific to venison. But I do know that what you're doing during the hanging process on beef is, because that's the one that we routinely hang, it's you're trying to denude the proteins, which is going to make it more tender. And also, so like, let's say that like you have like flavor is made up of like 100%, right? So the longer it hangs, the more moisture loss you're going to get. So that 100%, say, is like 10 to 20% water, and that's gone. So now you're left with, you know, that much more flavor that's not being cut by anything else. So if, and people, like, a lot of game is acquired. You know, some people will say that, you'll hear people say, like, I don't like the taste of X, Y, and Z. And it could be many reasons. Preparation, it could be because it didn't you know, bleed properly. It could have been because of a hanging factor. So the stuff I've had that my friends have processed, a lot of them do it like right away. You know, they'll do it that night. And they may, if you process stuff when it's still warm too, you're going to end up with a higher pH, which is going to make it a little bit more tackier. And that's not something you necessarily want, unless you're making hot dogs.
Good note, when making hot dogs, high pH.
Yeah. Yeah. And then those levels go down. But I don't get to try a lot of the stuff because, again, it's other people's. So the venison I do get to try is just because of friends and family and things like that.
Gotcha. Yeah, you get to find some more generous friends and family. I think maybe I'm going to have to send some stuff out to California for you to try.
Yeah.
Just wanted to take a time out and say thank you to the listeners for tuning in. It really does mean it. I would also appreciate that if you haven't already left a rating or review, to go ahead and do that. It all helps folks find us and get on board using and enjoying their wild game. Feel free to chat with us and ask questions either on Facebook, The Huntivore, or Instagram, at Huntivore. Got a recipe you think is dynamite and want to share? Or have some show topic ideas? Email us at huntivore@gmail.com. For even more hunting and fishing podcasts by real, relatable sportsmen, head over to Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, which happens to be a 2% for conservation company, who give 1% of their earnings and 1% of their time helping out the wildlife and wild places we all love. Now, back to the show. I experience this too. Like there's a point where you're going to have blood meat, you're going to have meat loss in the game as opposed to domestic, because domestic you cap to vault and then you're making cuts between joints up here at the neck and different areas. So you're leaving a lot of the blood is going out different cuts in different areas that mm-hmm. renders the carcass clean, whereas you're going to have some bleeding internally and intermuscularly in shot animals. Mm-hmm. Use a rifle or a shotgun, you're going to have more of that. And more of the rule or not that I have found that it's like, you know what, when it's red and, you know, bones are broken, you don't want to be eating that. That doesn't need to be going through anybody's ground. Give that mm-hmm. a fair amount of width on that, like, you know, really mm-hmm. cut that around. I've noticed though in my archery shots, and maybe specifically since I switched to a really sharpen tar out of these broadheads. They are wicked razor sharp, and the cut is super clean, and I get a lot of bleeding in the layers, in the brisket and between the ribs. Is there a way that once I approach that animal, let's say I'm able to get to that animal within the hour, how can I help alleviate some of that bleeding intermuscularly? Or is that one of those things like that's just going to happen?
So, what is happening there is, so when we knock animals, you could tell like if there was a bad bleed, because you'll get what's called blood spotting, usually in the skirt steak and in the hams. And that's just like, it just looks like little pepper. Like it just didn't drain fully. And the skirt steaks, you'll get them on lambs and pigs. You'll get them. On lambs, you get them in the skirt steaks, and pigs, you'll get them in the hams. And when, so gravity really, really helps with that. But when you have something going through the ribs, especially on something that's lean, like a deer, where it's going to get, where the muscles are easily separated and it starts getting stuck in the membrane, it's going to be difficult. I know a lot of people take, if they're, depending how much it is, will take that portion of their meat and soak it in like a brine, like a salt water, to help draw out some of the extra blood and before they process it. I don't know if that's a common thing. I just know some people do that. Not to all of it, but just to that area. And gravity really helps. And if rig is not set in yet, you could like move the legs, the front legs up and down to help kind of like get more out of the neck area. A lot of people don't like, if you're saving the cape, you necessarily don't want to, do a jugular cut. So it's again on the situation, but as soon as you get to a point where you can wash liberally with water at 2 inches, because that will also help reduce food contaminants, and then also just work the front legs to try to get as much out and use gravity to your advantage.
Gotcha. No, those are, I think, three tips I can really take, is really thoroughly rinse it. Maybe once I've pulled off, once I've broken it down, being able to maybe add a little bit of I've heard the brine idea, especially with like a liver, because it's still full of blood when you do pull it out. And that just helps take out some of that iron taste that you get from that. So maybe that might be a good one. Because what I'll try to do is that the ribs on venison has just kind of been my white whale. Like you try to figure out the best use of that cut, and being so lean and so worked, it's difficult, because there is a lot of that really like that tallow and that really thick fat that's on there. That's not very pleasing. So trying to make that palatable has always been a task, and each rib is different depending on what animal I get. Either I get one and I get a lot of this blood, or I, get zero blood loss in that because somehow it end up draining out. So it's a variable that, I come across once in a while, but maybe doing like what you're saying, get to it. If I do get to it quick, do the Mamba with the front side just to keep those things moving and push as much out.
Yeah. One of the last things we do is with beef is when we get it on the rail and it's all ready to be, before we start rinsing, we push the front leg all the way up, and then like, two cups of blood just fall right out of it.
Oh my goodness. That it's funny to think, like, you can handle a deer in not very long. I've done my own. I guess I haven't gone for speed. But I can do one in a day or an afternoon that I'm able to break one down and get it vacked up and away. I had the opportunity to purchase a beef quarter, the hind quarter. And I don't know, I had it in myself like, I know better. I'm going to cut this thing. Holy smokes, that filled the back of my truck. I got a short bed Silverado, And I mean, the sirloin was touching the one end and the hoof was going all the way to the other. What a comparison on these animals. When you guys are breaking down a beef, it is a task. It is literally, you're breaking the animal, but the animal, I think, is breaking you at the same time, just with its weight. When you're breaking a beef on a rail like that, you're using gravity as much as you can. When you're breaking that animal, going from a whole carcass that would overwhelm someone's thinking on how much, you know, steaks and roasts and all that, breaking it down into primals, or excuse me, quarters, and then into primals, kind of just helps block things in your mind. Mm-hmm. How are you breaking a beef on a rail? Like specifically, or maybe that's different for lamb. Like, do you have a rib count that you cut to have your front shoulders versus your saddle? And maybe we could apply that even into our own venison. What are some of those guidelines that maybe as you're breaking down from whole carcass to quarters, maybe we should start looking at?
Okay. So beef, you do your quarter break at between 12 and 13 rib. The 13th rib is your last rib. It's like a ghost rib. Sometimes there'll be a floater up there. So you have a whole side of beef. You're pretty safe by just finding the last rib and leaving that on the loin. And then you break that down, then you have a quarter. And to separate your chuck is going to have 5 bones, because you want to make sure that you have 7 bones on your ribeye, because the definition of like a 107A export is 7 bones. And then you're going to, there's half a dozen ways to break a beef four quarter too.
Gotcha. But
the easiest way is to count up your ribs and then break the chuck and the brisket and forearm all off as one piece. And then so your ribeye still has its short ribs on it. And then you either using a handsaw or a bandsaw to then take your chuck and forearm and cut it into 3 pieces. One would be your 5 bone chuck with the flat iron and mock tender still attached to it. And then the other would be your cross plate still attached to your, your what people call the cross rib or your shoulder clod. And then the other is going to be a forearm with the brisket still attached. And then that'll make it into more manageable pieces.
Gotcha. Folks, you can't see this, like, but we're on Zoom and I'm talking with Travis, and Travis is like I'm watching you, and it's like you're looking at the animal right here as you've done that description. It's like a beautiful mind sort of thing. Like, yeah, you're rotating that around, and some of the terminology I think is going to be different. Granted, you're going from, you know, a master butcher here in yourself, and then trying to talk to simpletons over on our side, you know, who are like, oh, we got this dead animal, now what? But I think you made a really good, like, talking about it being able to, like, at that last rib, make that separation so that now you've got your hindquarters, and then to complete your saddle, you wanted to have 7 ribs. I don't know if it's necessarily the same between venison and or like a whitetail versus a beef, but getting majority of your rib section, extending out the amount of ribeye that you're going to be able to take, and then leaving like a 5 up front. On a venison, it might be 4. We might have to take a look at that further. But anyway, like, looking at that and keeping 5 up front for your chuck. No, that's a great idea, because I think that's probably what the hardest things for hunters right now is, that we don't have a place to start. We just have this animal laying there. Mm-hmm. And I know even my buddies that, you know, they're like, Nick, come over and cut up my deer, because I don't even know where to begin. And as soon as you break it up into that, you're like, oh, I just have to worry about one leg. I don't have to worry about all the legs. Yeah. I think all of a sudden there's just this air let out of the room. Like, oh, this is manageable. I can understand what's going on here.
Yeah. And there's also like, so with like lamb, you know, it's similar can be similar in size. You would, you know, separate your shoulder, and then you would take your saddle with your flap still on it, and then your and then you would leave your sirloins on your legs. And but I also know that, like, when I process deer for people, a lot of times it was tenderloins, back straps, and then steaks out of the hinds, and then the rest was grind. And I also know too that depending on where you're located and things like that, you're gonna have to deal with chronic wasting disease.
Mm-hmm. It's here in Michigan, I tell you what, it's a problem.
Yeah. So there's gonna be rules about what bones you could keep depending on the game processor and depending on where you're located. So
gotcha. In the research that I've done, it's really with the CWD, skull and spine is really like mm-hmm. the get that out. You know, that's the first thing. You're not going to mess with that. And, but long bones, you're fairly safe. The further you get away from the spinal mm-hmm. column, I think that's where they've really kind of said, like, well, it's safer on this side. Generally, if I have the ability to test my animal, mm-hmm. and know that, you know, if it's contaminated with CWD or not, that's always the ultimate green light there at that point. It's like, kind of like, hold off using the bones until I figure out what this test says.
And then also, that being said, if it is, because it's something that I don't know that much about, if it is something that lives in or is active in the spinal column or the spinal cord, then you probably don't want to split your animals or split those cuts along those things, that you will want to bone out your saddle, leaving the vertebral column intact. You may want to do a rail break versus breaking through the vertebral column, where you're doing that, you know, pulling, separating your shoulders at that joint, and then breaking those down. And then I used to do it where I could bone out one leg, keeping the back strap, and then getting all the meat all the way down to the neck.
Wow.
In like 2 minutes. 2 minutes one side, though.
2 minutes one side. Oh, geez, come on. 4 minutes, I gotta wait.
Yeah.
As a processor, do you purposely keep one back strap? Because I've heard that too. That the butcher kept some of my meat. Like, I swear that deer was 200 pounds and they handed me back this 20 pound box.
Yeah. That's the thing that people are always like, it's one of the frustrating things about being a processor. If we wanted to keep meat, we could certainly not get caught for it. Two, that people don't understand yieldage, and I have no problem, like, cause I've had to deal with it in the past of like, you, people are more than, I certainly don't want to work in a fishbowl, but if people think something's happening, then stand there and watch me. But I'll also do yield tests and be like, this is how much bones you have. This is how much meat you have. This is how much, hair I felt like I wanted to trim off, which meant you lost this much meat or something like that. Or like, oh, you wanted me to hang it for 2 weeks. All right. This is the percentage of the loss. You know, if you have access to a hanging scale, then just mark those numbers down, because I used to hang carcasses, like whole beef carcasses, that I would hang for 3 weeks, and then I'd weigh them again to see what my loss was and factor that into my cost analysis. So and if you're processing and you have a CoolBot room that you're cutting in, and you have access to a scale, just know that just see what it is after you hang it for a week or two, because it's just also good to know and things like that. And also, if you're say you're making a dried product out of it, there's formulas with moisture loss, with weight, that will tell you if it's food safe or not.
You got to have a certain amount of water loss at that point for it to even be safe.
Yeah. So there's it's just fun. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think it's just complete just being naive at that point. You know, they thought they had a bigger deer than that. They're not impressed with what they got back. Where I've talked to a local guy, and he said, well, first off, that wasn't a big deer. And number two, we can go, like, just like you said, let's go weigh the other stuff. And I'm more than happy to walk you through cutting it. You know, if you want to do it yourself, by all means, because you're going to be shocked with how much you're actually getting off of that animal at that point.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, out of curiosity, when you were hanging those beef for 3 weeks, what poundage of moisture were you losing off those, just out of curiosity?
12% off of 1,000 pounds.
Jeez, we're talking like 100 pounds of just water.
Yeah. And the cooler, and I could see the water because I'd empty out the dehumidifier every day, because it was when you're hanging something that long, you want to create an environment that stuff can't grow in, because you don't want to end up with like a fuzzy mold. You want to end up with a bark. So that dehumidifier, I'd have to empty out it every day until I rigged it so it just drained out. But yeah,
I hear it from guys that are getting into cutting, and they're like, you know what, I'm trying to reduce the amount of grind. I want to get more whole cuts. I want to get more primals, roasts. I want to be able to do more like that and have less grind, or at the point where I'm cleaning a lot of meat off the bone. When you cut a deer, or you cut a venison, or even like when you cut a beef, you're going to cut it to the way that you want to eat. You know, if you've got the time to roast things, like, yeah, having more roasts. But I feel like some folks are starting to find that like ground is a failure. Like, I've failed this animal. And I know I personally had this idea after my first animal that I shot, not knowing, just being, again, naive, but I was going to do this myself, that I saw a large amount go to grind, that I feel like I failed the animal in breaking it down. But grinding isn't a failure at this point. You're gleaning as much off that animal as possible. When you're making venison ground, in your process, have you mixed it, or have you been traditionally like, hey, we're just going to do straight venison on through?
Depending on what the customer wants, right? So grinding and added value, like, for example, like hot dogs or something like that, or in venison, it would be summer sausage. Well, it would allow you to do whole carcass utilization, which is actually sustainability, and ensuring that the animal, nothing went to waste. So if a person approaches me and it's like, could you add this pork fat to my venison sausage, or could you add this beef fat? And so right now where I'm working, we get a real fatty beef, we'll harvest and make 5-pound bags for it, because we know in a month from now, people are going to start showing up and just buying those bags of fat off of us, and we know why. There's a lot of requests for that. And I don't see grind as a failure. I see it because, like, for me, people are like, what's your favorite cut of meat? And I always say ground beef, because it's so versatile. You could have a bolognese, you could have a hamburger, you could have tacos, you could have, you know, so many things that, you know, it's when you mess up a ribeye, you know, you messed up a ribeye, but when you messed up a chili, like, you just add more sriracha to it. But also another thing too, is if you want to get your chuck roll or that shoulder roll out of an animal, you could always make cuts smaller. You know, if you think you're going to be doing more roasting, you think you're going to be doing more or grilling, and that's not the case, and you're like, well, maybe I will just have some ground, you could always take that cut and grind it later after your freezer. You could also you know, take that shoulder roll and then cut a couple shoulder steaks out of it, depending. So if it is a fear that, you know, you could just leave them bigger.
I like that idea. And I appreciate what you're saying too, is like, this is value added. This is whole, animal use at this point, that grinding, like as you're practicing and you mess up a cut at the point of it being raw, yeah, just put it to the grind pile. You're going to have another opportunity the next year you get, or next year when you bring another animal down. Like, it's not the end all be all, but at the same time, like, how versatile a ground can be. That, like you said, million pieces of cuts that or million dishes that you can make off of just one thing.
Yeah.
I think that's a really powerful statement that I think keeps people out of doing their own butchery in the wild game sense, or even venison sense, is because I think folks are scared to make more ground.
Yeah. And there was something there that, I don't know. It'll come to me later. Yeah.
Profound, Travis. Yeah,
I drank too much last night. So.
Well, hey, Travis, we have come down to our crescendo of our show. This is the two-dish breakdown. Okay, this is it. Steaks cooked medium rare. Can I get my steak cooked just a little? That's not no question. You hungry? Hey, Ma! Can we get some meatloaf? We're doing the bougie.
Okay.
This is where I'm going to give you two scenarios. And first one is, it's more of a softball. This is a slow pitch softball league at that point. But the next one, I do add some heat to it. It's going to make you think a little bit harder. But for the first one, you've already used ground. So I'm going to pull ground off the table.
Oh, no.
Because I'm not going to ask your favorite. Mm-hmm. What I am going to ask is, what is, and you can go domestic on this. You can go any animal that you're looking for. What is an obscure cut of meat that you enjoy? And then tell me how you would prepare it. Is it a braise, a quick grill, a roast, however that's going to be done?
See, that's the thing with like obscure, because like I got to think about it from the consumer standpoint, not from my standpoint.
Very true. Everything is commonplace for you.
Because I'll just say hanger steak. I hear people say like they can never get it. And I was able to purchase two from a farmer this week because I cut them. and what I like to do with those is just it. Real simple is just seam it out so you have two portions, get that big piece of sinew or grizzle out of there, and then season it like fajitas, and then just grill them on a flat top, and then it makes super good carne asada.
Nice. Now, where exactly is the hanger steak for folks that are struggling to figure out where that would be on a beef? Where am I going to find that?
You're going to find it on the spine, hanging off just below the tenderloin, connecting to the skirt steaks. And it is the diaphragm. It splits off into two pieces, and that's where your digestive system and your respiratory system cardiovascular system pumps the blood to the lower extremities, and your the throat connects to the stomach.
So, gotcha.
It is the separation. It is the diaphragm that separates the lung cavity from the stomach cavity.
And I know there's a bunch of hunters that have touched and cut around that piece and probably thrown it away. This might be added value right here that we can get out of our venison, depending on, shot placement, of course.
Yeah, on a venison, it'll be like that big. And on a beef, they're like that big.
Yeah.
Great for a podcast, giving visual references.
So folks, yes, this big for that and this big for the beef. So yeah, you're just doing a quick grill on either side, just adding some color, just adding a sear to it, mm-hmm. and then cut cross grain, I'm assuming, on that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Man. Folks, pull out your hangers, pull out your Venny hangers. They're small, but I'm telling you, they're probably super delicious.
Yeah, and there's like a bunch of stuff in your flaps that you can get off your saddle. You know, you can get your, what would be comparable to your, there's a bunch of good flat meat in there. And then if you want to, you know, have bone in cuts for stocks and stuff, use the fore shanks and the hind shanks. So,
oh yeah, that would, if I had to pull my favorite cut off a deer, I've said this in other episodes too, like the shank is probably my favorite, just mm-hmm. like the grind, you can stew that stuff down and then it can go, like you said, tacos, burritos, you name it, whatever. Asobuco for fancy. You can do anything you want and it's just so flavorful. So yeah, I really enjoy the shank.
Yeah.
This is going to come with some more weight because it's a date night. Mm-hmm. Kids gone, the house, you know, it's just you and the wife and you were on a date night, but you happen to be cooking. You're doing a date inside. Pandemic. Mm-hmm. Let's call it that. You have to cook inside. You have at your disposal a piece of wild game. What are you going to make for your date mm-hmm. to make this just go just right?
Can land animals or
you? I'm saying wild, can't be domestic. So if it comes out of the sea, I'll allow it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because that's easy. I'm making my wife's favorite, which is salmon. You know, we get kings running out here. We get about 100 pounds of salmon in it. So it would just be real easy. Salt, pepper, olive oil, lemon, baked or grilled, skin on, skin down. And then it would be the whole fillet with asparagus, maybe on the side, maybe a vinaigrette salad and some homemade tartar sauce. That I would have to look up the recipe every time. So,
hey, if it's a homemade tartar sauce, that's worth writing down and then referencing every time.
And then just something like that. And then, you know, depending on the weather, we'll eat on the deck or, And then my wife would be like, just surprised that I cooked.
That alone sets the mood right there. Yeah. Like, holy smokes.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, definitely that would be what I would do for
her. Oh, I'm getting a little interference here. Hold on. I think we got a little lag. He's back.
Okay.
We lost you there for a second.
All right.
You were saying that was what you would make for her. Now, were you saying what you were going to make for yourself?
It'd be the same thing, but halibut. So I like halibut a lot more than salmon.
Now that's a whiter, flakier flesh. Am I right?
Yeah. And that I would actually bake in, like almost with like a half stick of butter wrapped in parchment paper.
And then, I don't think you can go wrong with anything if you're adding a stick of butter and wrapping it in parchment paper.
Yeah. And then other game I like you know, duck if it's done, you know, correctly. So that I've done. So yeah.
Well, awesome. Those are excellent choices there on that. You hit a home run on yeah. that date. I think it went really well.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Travis, this has been a great hour. I don't want to take a ton of your time. Where can my listeners jump over and find more what you're doing and more about the Meat Block podcast? Where can folks really dive in deep into the content you're throwing out?
So at American Butcher on TikTok and Instagram, if you like watching videos of me talking to myself. And it's really weird. I don't get the people enjoy it. And then the Meat Block podcast, we have an Instagram. We don't utilize it as much as we should. But our podcast with 174 episodes and 140 something 5-star reviews can be found on anywhere you can download podcasts. Spotify, Google Play, Apple, Spreaker, Stitcher, all those. And a lot of people start in chronological order. We do everything from interviews to talking about just mental health to talking everything. So with over 170 episodes, we still managed to come up with new ways to at least entertain ourselves. So
well, I give it a 4-star, or excuse me, I give it a 5-star. I was gonna say, I thought it was a 4-star scale. No, 5-star. I really do enjoy it, and it does. It gets you thinking about just the process that you're doing as a farm kid who grew up doing that. Like I resonate with it, and at the same time, like being a sportsman and wanting to get the most out of my game. Like this is just ideas that go. Each episode, I find a new little piece of information that I can apply into what I'm doing in my own setup. So, bravo. Keep it going. And we'll send people over there.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
So, hold on. Fun. Yeah. Hold on just a second, Travis. I'm going to let the folks out here go. Folks, we are in that crunch time. If you haven't finished your sighting in your shotgun or your rifle, this is the time to do it. If you still need to get your layout blinds for waterfowl set up, this is also the time to do it. But in all that preparation, don't forget to think about after the shot. Have your gut bag ready to go. And in that gut bag better be a knife. And I hope that knife is sharp.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.